Hi everyone. My name is Sana Ahmed. I am the founder of the Product Marketing Institute, and I am also the founder of the Thought Leadership with the Product Marketing Magazine. What I like to do every week is bring on thought leaders in the technology industry who are movers and shakers and are using product marketing to a degree to be able to drive innovation in a company. I wanted to take this episode as a way to shine light on how we can utilize mental health and be the best versions of ourselves to be able to continue to do well and succeed, not just short term, but also long term as well in the technology space. And I'm extremely excited to bring on my guest, Sari Day, who actually deals in this entire sector. And she's been making a lot of moves here and has already helped so many people. So, without further ado, sorry, I'd love for you to take it over and give an introduction on yourself and all the great stuff you've been doing.
Thanks so much for having me, first of all. I'm really excited to be here. So, yeah, my name is Sari, and I am a leadership and career coach for women who are navigating stress and burnout. And I help them both step back from burnout as well as figure out their career either up or off the corporate ladder. My life mission is to help more women and people of color step into leadership positions, and particularly to help them break the glass ceiling. And I think stress and burnout and exhaustion is a huge part of why women in particular leave the workforce at that particular inflection in their careers.
All exciting stuff, and I want to dissect each of those things with you. And you yourself have also been in technology, right? What has your experience been like? You've had a very illustrious career. You've been in very different aspects of it. So, before I jump into specific questions for you, I would also love to sort of learn what your path was and like what inspired you to also get to this amazing thing that you're doing right now.
Yeah, so I started out my career in advertising. So I spent 10 years at some of the biggest advertising agencies in the world, in London and Europe, and as well as here in the US and Australia, which is where I'm from.
Nice.
And
Where's the Australian accent?
yeah, I know. I've been here for a long time, and my
Okay.
husband and my cat are both American. So,
Awesome.
and after 10 years at ad agencies, I made the switch to client side, and I worked for, brands like Microsoft and Allianz Insurance and Procter and Gamble, Johnson and Johnson. And then I moved client side to T-Mobile, where I was the product marketing manager for customer retention and loyalty. And after that, Facebook in Silicon Valley, where I was product marketing manager for the ads measurement products. And that was a very different experience, especially being kind of in the valley and in like deep in the technology space. And I'd also reached that inflection point in my own career where, you start to make decisions about, do I want to have a family and can I sustain my career and my family? It was also an interesting time to be in Silicon Valley. The Me Too movement had just started. People were, the Uber scandal, people were marching out of Google. Women and people of color were starting to stand up for themselves more and speak out about their experiences in a way that hadn't happened before. And I was in a position where I was not only working with more people of color than ever before, but also hiring and seeing, from the inside the challenges that particularly, women of color faced. And being a woman of color myself, was starting to experience those challenges firsthand. And so I kind of just reached a point where I was sick of complaining and trying to make change on a small scale and decided that I wanted to kind of commit my career to helping redress this imbalance. And so now I work with really ambitious women, but I also work on a corporate and enterprise level with companies trying to change their policies on diversity, inclusion, hiring, training.
It's so bold of you, so brave, bold, but it takes a level of also taking some time to self-reflect, right? And getting to know yourself too. That's pretty exciting. Like, I'm curious to that point of inflection. Like, if we were to just drill down into that, like, how did you sort of even give yourself the opportunity to try to self-reflect at that point and say, like, this is what I'm going to end up doing? Like, how did it all sort of click together for you?
So when I talk about that inflection point, I think most women, and I work almost exclusively with women, so that's kind of where my experience comes from, reach that point at around the same time, right? So it's like kind of your late 20s, your early 30s. And if you're a smart, ambitious person, you'll find that, you know, these people progress pretty rapidly through the early stages of their career, and they're always seen as like ambitious go-getters, and are pretty kind of career focused and define a lot of their identity from their careers. And I can totally identify with that. And I think, you know,
me too.
Exactly. And then you kind of reach this point where the roles start to get fewer and fewer because you're starting to move towards the top. Your commitments outside of work start to increase because, you know, we suddenly start to see that we have to invest in our marriages. Our parents are getting older and they need more of our attention, or we're deciding to have children and, you know, family commitments are coming up. And so the outside stresses increase, the work stresses increase because you're also at that point in your career where, you know, everyone is smart and ambitious if they're kind of up for promotion or looking to climb, you know, to the next step. And it's those soft skills that a lot of us haven't grown up with or haven't been taught that really, really matter, and that inevitably lead to burnout because we think, okay, like, we'll just keep working harder and harder and harder. And the core of this comes down to we've made a decision about our careers usually in our early 20s, and a decade has passed, usually a pretty transformative decade. I mean, very few people are exactly the same at 31 than they were at 21, right? Like, so much of their lives have changed.
Or 34, 35, right? From even 33 or 32.
Totally. And so for me, I hit my late 30s actually and realized that I was still marching towards this goal. I, you know, wanted to be CMO, maybe CEO, that I had set for myself at 21 years old, but I wasn't the same 21-year-old who decided that's what I wanted my life goal to be. And then there comes this wrestle of, but I've invested, you know, for some of us, nearly two decades into this career, and I'm wedded to the paycheck because I have financial obligations. And so when I have clients like that who say, well, either it's okay, I actually like my job, I'm just not sure where to go next. Or clients who say, I've been doing the same thing for so long, but I haven't stopped to question whether this thing is still the thing I want. The answer for me is always the same. And it comes back to, like, what are the values that drive you? Because they should stay consistent. And I think that especially is what helps avoid burnout. Because burnout happens when you don't have a higher motivation or a bigger picture for your life, and you feel like you're a hamster on a wheel just going through the motions. And the way that I think about that is that, have you ever worked on a project that you just really believed in and felt really inspired by the team and the people around you and the thing that you were building, and the vision that the engineering team and the product team had for it? And it's just as stressful. Sometimes it's even more stressful than the day-to-day work. And the hours are probably really long, but you're so energized that it doesn't feel like a grind, right? It feels like this thrilling, exciting, rewarding thing that you're working on, regardless of how many hours you're putting in. And there is a difference between the stress and the burnout, right? Like, stress is something that's like an everyday manageable emotion, whereas burnout is something far bigger, and it usually ties to a lack of meaning in your life. And so if we can come back to our values, and for me, my values had changed so deeply that, you know, I didn't want to lead through a job title. I wanted to lead through service. And that had always been part of my values. But now I have a chance to live that every single day in my work.
That's so, so nice to hear. And I can not only just see it from your energy, but I can hear it from like just your entire being, like how you're so much more fulfilled and satisfied. And by, I think we were talking about this a little bit earlier, like when you learn to be self-compassionate towards yourself, you start to understand how to get the best out of yourself for yourself, but then also for other people. So it's like this thing of mental health and like health, just health overall is so important. And you mentioned some brilliant things that I have frankly not heard from other people before. So thank you for sharing this. And this is just such a beautiful conversation that I'm excited to just get in front of as many women as possible. You talk about like our goals and like specifically from a career setting. Yeah, we've made a lot of these goals from when we were like college graduates, like early professionals in our early 20s. And I myself am also into my 30s now too. And yeah, it's just such a different thing where, you know, I can even sort of comment on myself where I knew a few values that I had. When you talk about values and sticking to that as sort of your guardrail, I knew that I wanted to have a human to human experience. I always wanted to have great relationships, motivate, mentor people at an early age. I wanted to continue to learn and grow, but I wanted to enjoy my experience of being able to do all this because I knew from very stressful academic situations that I learned the best when I was enjoying everything that I was doing. And so I knew that that situation would apply in the work setting too. And you mentioned that as well, which is like, imagine if you work on projects that you truly believe in, and it's it ends up being such a joyful thing that that's a different kind of stress than a burnout stress. So a few things there, which is like the needs that we have are changing, if not, you know, even every few months or a year, every year or two, if we even look at it from like 3 to 5 year segments, like what we wanted maybe even 3 to 5 years ago, let alone in our 20s, are completely different. And if I were to make a generalization, I would say for women, as we get into our 30s, as our obligations also kind of increase personally and professionally, I want to really think about like scale and sustainability, right? I have a good friend who always tells me, because he saw me from, we became very good friends and motivated each other. And he's like, Sana, you know, no one's going to look back on life and say, I wish I had worked more, and I'm going to reward myself with more work. It's just really about trying to figure out like the right balance of how do you keep yourself motivated in a healthy way, right? How do you come from a place of strength, not fear, which is something, another thing that you and I were talking about as well. Because like, unfortunately, sometimes when you're in competitive situations, whether it's corporate or maybe even personal as well, right? Like there's all these demands that you have, these expectations. And a lot of the times we come from a place of, I need to do X, Y, and Z, because if I don't, then, you know, something bad will happen. And it's like, I need to be CMO by 35, because if I don't, then all of my, you know, 15, 20 years of experience was completely wasted. And it's like, why even create these paradigms to begin with, where we end up doing one extreme to feed into the other extreme. And it's like, if you don't get this from point A to point B, then it's like the journey didn't matter. And that's actually quite opposite, right? It's the journey actually matters just as much, or if not more, as they've done in studies, than the actual, you know, endpoints or the milestones that you're reaching. So now I have a question for you, which is, how do we even create that journey in a way that's healthy and sustainable, so that it's just as rewarding and that we're not waiting for this very specific output, you know, if this, then that, and if not that, then like, you know, everything's in vain. How do we break out of that mindset, and how do you find yourself doing that with yourself and even with your clients, right?
Yeah, so I think there's a danger in separating your career from your life and thinking about them as sort of different things, right? Like your work and your career should fuel the kind of life that you want to be living. And again, I come back to like, what are your values and what are the things that you want for yourself? So one of the things that I always ask my clients is like, what kind of life matters to you? What kind of life do you want to be living? And there's tons of, I have a structured activity that we do where you answer a series of kind of questions in order to get to that answer. But a really simple question to ask yourself is like, what do you want on your tombstone? What do you want people to say about you at your funeral? And, you know, for me, when I think about the things that matter most to me, you know, I want people to know that I was a person of integrity. And so I always act with integrity or my version of it, because that word can mean so many different things to different people. I want people to say she was a great friend. So at times when I have to make the choice, I ask myself, like, does this make me a better friend? Because that's the value that matters to me the most. But also, if your goal is to spend as much time with your kids as possible, it's okay to admit that that is your priority and that you work in order to provide for your family. And that maybe that doesn't always mean that you have to climb the ladder, right? Like, I see a lot of women doing that. And I call it the should statements. How many should statements are in your life? I should apply for a promotion, even though it's going to mean longer hours, even though it's going to mean more work that doesn't satisfy me because it means less time with my five-year-old. Well, if your priority is to have more time with your five-year-old, there is no should about climbing the corporate ladder, because that's what you should be doing, right? Like, trying to figure out what will bring you the most joy in your life. And I think there's a lot of fear around living a joyful life. Like, people are afraid of joy. Like, there's something dangerous about being too happy or too joyful, right?
I'm laughing at that, because there's a lot of transitions that I've went over in the course of a year or two. And I found my friends and family also just saying, like, you know, just try to take some time, just chill and relax. And I would just be like, but I can't, I have all this work waiting for me and I need to go do it. And I too transitioned into being an entrepreneur as well. And it was such an interesting concept for me, because someone like me, who's very self-competitive, where I'm always looking to see how I can push myself and get the best out of myself, the concept of joy, like, I had shut that out, because I'm like, well, if I relax a little too much, then I will give away my desire, my motivation to wanting to wake up in the morning and get the best out of myself. So I will still admit, I'm much better now, but I will admit that there is still a fear that sometimes I have that sort of creeps up, right? Because we all have our fears and we're not 100% cured of it, but it's how we mitigate it. So that's sort of like a question I have for you. Like, if I were, if I were your client right now, and we were just having a question, conversation around this, it's like, How do I become unafraid of joy and invite that more into my life, trusting myself and knowing that I'm still going to be the Sana that wakes up the next day and is still just as motivated, if not more, to still be able to give 100% to my work, where it's not, joy is not going to be a distraction, but it's going to be sort of like this integrated part that's going to fuel everything I'm doing, right?
Yeah, totally. So this resistance to joy is very typical of, you know, the type A personalities that we find, particularly in tech, right? Like, that personality is for some reason very attracted to tech. And I coach a lot of women who share this reluctance or resistance to joy as a regular part of their day, because they're so focused and so high achieving that they feel like joy will cause them to take their eye off the ball. But when you dig a little bit deeper, there's a couple of things sort of underlying that. So the first is that many of us have been conditioned through our childhood to believe that we are the sum total of our success. And that's because you come back from school with good grades and your parents say, wow, well done. And your small child brain registers that hit of approval and dopamine and pride as, when I succeed and get good grades, I win approval from the people who love me. I earn love through success. And that's not the fault of our parents in any way at all, nor is it the fault of our child selves, but it is a correlation that our brains make. And for some of us, that correlation is, for many of us, that correlation is very, very strong into adulthood. And it might not be as literal as, you know, I want to win the approval of my mom or dad, but it comes down to, you know, I want to win the approval of my colleagues on some level, or my manager, or the company I work for, or the people who follow me on LinkedIn, right? And so we're conditioned to believe that our worth is tied to our achievements and our successes, and that we just existing in the world as human beings aren't enough or aren't worthy enough of attention or love or pride. So me just walking around being a good person isn't enough to make the people who love me proud of me. And so working through that idea that our worth is inherent to us and not tied to our achievements can be one, I think, important path to joy. I think the other half of that equation is the imposter syndrome, which tends to speak extremely loudly at our times of success too.
Especially for a woman too, right? Totally. This is something that we kind of suffer from, but yeah, go ahead.
100%. And I definitely see it with men too, but we have the additional layer of these like social pressures that we're battling that are unique to women. And so when that imposter syndrome is yelling really loudly during times of success, it means that our moments of joy become laced with this kind of fear, right? Like, oh, I've achieved this thing, but it wasn't really me that achieved it. It was luck, or it was the team, or what if I can't recreate this success again because I'm not actually good enough and this was a total fluke? Or, and so that propels us away from joy and we start working out of fear again.
That's such an interesting dynamic, right? It's like, how do you not fall back into these habits? And again, how do you sort of find those guardrails? What's interesting to me, what I am finding, even in my journey as an entrepreneur too, is when I give myself permission to relax and become a little bit more organized with my time, where it's like, don't think about work right now, like don't worry about these existential threats of like, well, if I don't do this, I'll fall behind in the marketplace or what have you. Those moments of relaxation end up being moments of inspiration, because what I find is like, I'll get like this just sprint of inspiration of like, oh, this is how I could be doing something completely different that will save me time, effort, energy, and actually help me enjoy, you know, what I continue to do as well. And so it's this, you know, it's like trying to remind yourself that joy is not the enemy. It is part of this catalyst and this fuel that helps you continue to move forward, going forward again. So yeah, how do we not fall back into fear? Like, do you have any exercises around that, especially for women? Because like you mentioned, the extra layer, right? There's always these triggers that are around us that are pulling us back in, right? Like demands as mothers or sisters, as daughters, in the workplace, where it's like we are aware of the glass ceiling as well. And we have to work a little bit harder, or so it seems, to be able to, you know, constantly prove ourselves. Is there a permanent like solution or a cure to that of not falling into fear?
I think the permanent solution is that you have to work at it constantly, right? Like it's not a one and done thing. It's a lifelong practice to own your fear, and to acknowledge it, right? Like our fear serves a really important part in our lives. Fear keeps us safe. Fears are like warning system, and you know, we call it our instincts, or we call it gut feeling, but fear is there for a reason. It's just that for so many of us, particularly in deeply competitive working environments, our fear is activated at all the wrong times, because we're in constant, almost fight or flight mode. We constantly feel threatened about our place in the world, about the stability of our job, about you know, our own sense of self-worth. So that fear is acting out of self-preservation. So I always say, like, thank your fear, acknowledge it, thank it, say, you know, thank you so much for keeping it, for trying to keep me safe. I appreciate what you're doing, but we're okay here. Like, you can let that fear go. I think a very close partner of fear is also, you know, envy or jealousy, as we compare ourselves to others. So one of the things that I tell my clients is that you can take that envy and use it as a guide to navigate what your soul or your heart is really crying out for. So we tend to envy the things in others that we want for ourselves. So, you know, I have one client who says, I really envy this woman because she seems like such a great mom. And I said to her, you know, you envy that because that's where you feel like you're failing. So that's the part of your life. And it doesn't mean that she is failing. It's just that's where she feels like she's failing. So that's the part of your life that is crying out for the most amount of attention and help from you. And so envy can be a kind of, or fear can be a kind of navigation tool for us to figure out what parts of our lives aren't serving us best.
That's so powerful, extremely powerful, extremely brilliant, everything you're saying. One thing I was just thinking of as you were talking about, like, acknowledge your fear and use it also as a guide to show you where you want, you know, what you're calling out for. That's actually pretty powerful, right? Bear with me as I make this product marketing analogy. If we were to look at ourselves as a product, and we look at ourselves through the development cycle, and, you know, we ultimately have to package ourselves and product market ourselves at the end of the day, right? This now definition of fear, how you've defined it, which is so powerful and empowering, use that as a way to understand your product requirements, right? Like, okay, what are the fears telling me right now in terms of what my needs are? How have my needs changed, you know, at this point in my life? And how do I build a positive, you know, strategy and solution from there? So I can't but help use that product development and marketing like framework as a way of being able to do that. The second thing, you know, as you were talking about this, fear is also like a really great indicator of just confidence in yourself as well, right? I read a lot of books on neuroscience, as I was telling you, because I love sort of learning about how do you train yourself to be your best. And it's how do you, part of what they say is like ultimately the people who also kind of carry through with their goals are the ones who end up having higher confidence. And so how do you have higher confidence? And the best way to do that is to build, to know that it is number one, an achievable goal, and number two, creating yourself habits every day in which you can trust that, you know, I will wake up in the morning at this time, I'm going to brush my teeth, shower, I'm going to spend, you know, X amount of time from this time to work on this specific goal. And by getting into that habit, you end up having this very sustainable way, like project planning your way into being able to launch that goal and execute it well. Would you sort of agree with that? What is your sort of perspective on that? Like, where can you use fear as like as a way of like trying to gauge your confidence, and then from there try to build up your confidence and tell that irrational mind that wants to take over, like, oh no, this is too hard, or it's impossible, or it's like, wait a minute, we can scope this, and like it is possible, and maybe it's not in 15 days, maybe in 30 days or 45 days or a year that something like this is possible and I can still have this. Maybe not originally as the way that I thought, but maybe in a different way, and I can be open, you know, to what that output looks like.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's, the goal isn't to eliminate fear from your life. Like, that is a natural part of the spectrum of emotions, and brave people feel fear as well, and confident people feel fear as well. And I think fear is also a good indicator that you're growing, right? Like, you can't be wedded to both growth and your comfort zone. They're mutually exclusive places. And so the goal, as I said, isn't to eliminate fear. It's to use fear in some way as a navigation tool, whether it's questioning your fear and saying, hey, is this fear coming up because it's trying to keep me safe and I should pay attention to that signal? Or is that fear speaking to me because of my lack of self-worth, because of my imposter syndrome? And knowing yourself well enough to know where that fear is coming from and what the quality of that fear is. Should I listen to this fear? Because there are instances where you absolutely should listen to that cautionary fear that's coming up. But ultimately, our mind is conditioned to protect us. You know, one of the great things my gym instructor said to me years ago that's always stuck with me is that your mind will give up before your body. So your mind will tell you that you're tired before your body is actually tired, because your mind is trying to prevent your body from getting to that place where the muscles break down and you know, get exhausted. So you need to just tell your mind, got it, I heard you, and push through, right? You can do that. And so I think interrogating your fear and knowing how to do that in a way that's kind and compassionate is really important. But the other part of what you talked about was kind of having this roadmap. And it's surprising to me how many of my clients don't, and just people in general, don't have a roadmap for their lives. Like, where are you planning to be in 5 years or 3 years, or even your career? Like, do you have a roadmap for your career with steps to get there? Because we would never do that for our products, right? As responsible product marketing people, we always have a 6 month, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plan for where we want our products to go. And we build backwards from that. And we plan backwards from that, especially when they're huge problems that we're trying to solve and we need to break them down into bite-sized steps. And the number of times I also hear, well, I work really hard and I, you know, do the right thing and that should get me promoted or that should get me closer to the life that I want. We would never say that about our teams. If everyone just turns up and work really hard, we'll build that product in 5 years. We would still have a plan in place and we would still have a roadmap to get there and we would still have a vision that we're all marching towards. And so knowing where it is that you want to go can be incredibly motivating. I'm doing the scary thing because in 3 years' time, I want to be here. So for me, the fear of leaving my paycheck and leaving my 9-to-5 and leaving the comfort of, you know, healthcare and safety and knowing where to go every morning in order to be an entrepreneur and start my business. And being an entrepreneur is totally a faith-based thing, by the way. You work a lot and there may not be a paycheck at the end of it.
It's taking a lot of risk and there is no promise to a specific outcome because you're kind of creating the path as you walk it, right?
Absolutely. And for me, the risk and the fear was absolutely there in the, you know, but I had a plan for the life that I wanted to live, and the life that I wanted to live was one that aligned with my values around freedom and integrity and enough time and space to be with my family and to see my parents more than once a year because they're in Australia and I was living in the US. And in order to live that life, I needed to take the risk. And so the fear became, I guess, not as great as the risk of not doing the thing that scared me.
That's such a good point that you mentioned there. It's like this sort of like this balancing act, right? Where it's like, how do you end up taking action? Is it like, does the fear sort of win and then you don't take the action, or you assess the risk and you're like, well, I'm willing to be brave and know that there is no, you know, specific promise outcome, but I will still try and I will still move towards that direction. And so therefore that experience itself is rewarding in itself, even though I may not get, you know, the outcome in that way. It's kind of, if I were to say what you said, that's sort of like the formula of an entrepreneur for me, at least, because that's something, you know, that I was sort of dealing with about a year and like 2 months ago, where it's like, I really wanted to do this. I wanted to run my business ever since I graduated college. I'm like, I don't know what it is. And I want to try to figure it out. And there's a handful of people who are like, no, you should sort of jump back into work right away and just like try to worry about this and do this on the side. And then there are other people who are like, well, if you've planned for this and you've really thought it through, then yeah, definitely like move towards it. And I did my own risk assessments as well. And I'm like, well, I'm going to give myself this amount of time to be able to launch myself and do that. And, you know, maybe I'm not going to be able to, I don't know, let's just say when you're on a fixed budget now, I may not be traveling as much, or I may not be buying things as much. Those are things, you know, that matter for people, but I will be able to budget myself and sustain myself and really be able to give myself this new experience that I actually can't buy off a shelf or go anywhere else. And so therefore I'm going to do this and I'm going to move forward with it. And I know that something will come out of it as a result, but I still had to do all the other legwork as well. Like you were saying, like, create your roadmap. Like, what is the plan? You know, where do you see yourself? And I literally had done this for myself. I have whiteboards all around my home office where it was like Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. I think one thing that I probably struggled with early on, which I think you're invaluable for with the people you work with, is like, how do you want to feel as you're doing these things, right? And how do you want to do it in a sustainable way? I had these big goals that I wanted to like get done by like Q1. And there were like things that I was creating, like courses and books. And I thought I would be done with it like 2 months into my self sabbatical, but it actually took a little bit more time, like for about 6 months. And so it's like, how do you also kind of keep yourself in check there too, right? Where you're creating realistic goals that are reachable and that it's not costing you, like having a life, like being able to sacrifice balance or like your physical, emotional, mental well-being, because like you're, you know, at the computer, you know, through 1, 2, 3 a.m. And this is typical of entrepreneurs, right? We replace sometimes one like long, laborious like day in like corporate America, and then we replace that with what we think would be like also what we think we have to do in the same way. But it's like, how do you pause and sort of try to assess like, how am I going to do all of this in a way that makes sense? And again, magic word is also joyful as well, right?
Totally. Yeah. I think so. In terms of like actionable strategies, one of the things that helps my clients and frankly me is, what is the risk of not doing it? So like, here's the fear. What's the risk of not, of giving into the fear and not taking the action? And then what's the worst thing that can happen? Because sometimes articulating the worst thing can make you realize how big or small or how much it's been kind of blown out of proportion, right? Like, the worst thing that can happen is I'll fail. Okay, what happens if you fail? Well, maybe not, you know, I'll get ostracized by all of my friends and family. You know, that comes up a lot. People will think less of me, or I will disappoint my loved ones. And when you put it out there, will you really disappoint your loved ones if you tried something and it didn't go exactly the way that you wanted it to? Is their love for you that fragile? Or is their approval for you that based on your success? And having those conversations can be really, really powerful. I think too, if you're operating from a place of joy, you tend to take away the should. I talk about this a lot too, like the should statements, like, oh, I should work out, or I should eat this thing that's making me sad to eat, or because it's good for me, or I should work 80 hours a week because now that's what it's going to take for my business to succeed. And when you operate from a place of joy and you operate through the lens of like, these are my values, everything changes because the work you do is so much more meaningful that it really doesn't feel like work, and you're enjoying it, and the time goes quickly, and your brain is laser focused because, you know, it's vibrating from a place of joy. And I see that every day in my work, and I see too how much that shift has actually enabled success for me. I mean, I feel so lucky that, you know, I make more money than I did at my corporate job doing the thing that I love to do every single day. And I think a lot of people feel that, like, you know, oh, joy isn't financially profitable. And I'm here to tell you that most successful people started from a place of joy, of doing something that they really believed in that brought them joy.
There's like 3 points I want to expand on there. And that's so exciting for me to hear that, because I was telling you earlier too, that just by interacting with you and having the pleasure of connecting with you and seeing what you're doing, I'm taking your inspiration and giving myself the confidence also of saying, well, I know that this is something I want to do for myself, but I see that Sari is doing it in her own way with her own work, and it is possible. So it's like that irrational mind, you know, the fear of like, am I kind of going crazy? Am I like pursuing something that maybe doesn't make sense and I should just throw the towel on it? You know, those will be, I think, conversations or voices that entrepreneurs have. But it's so important to also find people that inspire you and your support groups who can think on that same wavelength, because it's like, oh, wait a minute, I was like losing my balance. And it's like, I just met someone who, you know, trekked through and made it through, and she's joyful and she's profitable and she's able to give more to everyone around her, which are all the things that are part of the values that I actually started my business with. So even when I know that, you know, there are days where it's like, I have a lot of energy where I could do things, some days I don't. I happen to be fasting this month. And so it's like being realistic too with how many hours I can put in a day. You know, for other women too, like I know I've had a lot of friends who were pregnant, for example. And like when you're pregnant, you end up having to take naps during the day because you have a baby growing inside of you. Mm-hmm. And so how do you acknowledge that and not feel bad or label yourself as unmotivated or lazy, right? How do you know that it's like, I'm still going to hold on to my values? And my values were similar to yours as well. I wanted to do things joyfully. I didn't want to work these crazy 16-hour days. And I just knew that if I can just sort of hold on to those two things and come out with something that's sustainable, then I will, you know, follow through with my path. And part of that is what I'm doing right now too, where I get to do this awesome product marketing magazine. There's another thing that I sort of want to mention. There's two more things. One is looking at things from like a customer journey perspective, which I'll hold for the last point. But the certain trigger words, like when you say things like, you know, where we find this inner dialogue with ourselves, like I should be doing this or I should be doing that, despite me feeling a certain way. In all my readings that I enjoy doing, and I think you articulate very well, is like, how do we unify our whole selves, right? Where it's not where I'm shutting off my emotions to be able to let my mind take over. How do I bring my mind, my body, my soul, my physiology into everything I'm doing, where it's like one should not be neglected over the other. It's like to be unafraid that I can actually do that and be able to find balance. And there are things where it's like modern philosophy. I remember from like philosophy 101, it was Descartes who had mentioned like, I think therefore I am. And I was sitting there in philosophy of the human person, and the professor was saying, well, it's like this very term, this very sentence that Descartes said unfortunately ended up making the modern world kind of function in this dichotomy of like mind and body. And it has this implications on the modern world of like things like medication, where it's like, you think you have to eat a food or supplement or medication, even though it's making you feel bad, because it's like, that's what you should be doing, right? And then there's this whole other element of should, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with Brené Brown.
I love her.
By the way, I hope every woman reads her books, because a friend of mine who, when I was working with her at Facebook, actually gave me some of her books, A Call to Courage. And there was another one. I'm trying to
Dare to Lead.
Daring Greatly. Yeah. Dare to Lead and Daring Greatly. Yes. You've read my mind. Those are the two books that I ended up reading. And it was actually on point, because I was going through this transition, right, where I thought I had to overcome my emotions, because you hear that a lot in the workplace. Don't be emotional, like be objective. But like emotions are also supposed to be there to help motivate you and guide you, right? To be able to help you also think objectively as well. Because the moment you shut down emotions in a profession like product marketing, like something you and I have done, if we shut that off, how are we supposed to have customer empathy? And customer empathy is what drives a lot of what we do to be able to do it at the quality, right?
Totally.
Brené Brown also mentions words like should, and should being a shame word. There's a whole, like, I think little table, if I remember correctly, where she's like, you say these words and you have to start paying attention to yourself and saying that this is sort of where the fear ego is kind of coming, or the shame ego, for example, because our society, like many societies, and especially women, we're constantly dealing with this, because there's so many standards that we have depending on the social circles or situations we're in. Like, I should be this. I should be an all-star like cook, like my mom, who's amazing at everything she does, but then I'm not. Or, you know, I should have a pristine living situation, or, you know, I should be this, or I should be married at this time, or have a child at this time. And so it's like those should words are such a great like indicator of like, just pay attention to, you know, whose voice that is. Is that something that has been impressed on us? Or is that also part of like what we want? And it's like, how do you dissect that? And the last piece I want to throw in here, and I'd love your perspective on this as well, is like, I'm going to put the product marketing hat back on, because product marketing again is being able to understand the needs of a customer and then come up with strategies and solutions in a creative way as well, right? To be able to market to the needs of the customer. And again, if we look at ourselves as the customer, the user, or the customer, however you want to say it, and you know, we constantly ask ourselves like, what is our need and how are we going to end up solving this need? And you know, then you put your problem solving hat back on. One of the exercises we have done, and I'm sure you've done this too, as a product marketer, is like map out the customer journey. And as you map out the customer journey, you map out like all the different points they take to be able to reach their goal, to fulfill their need. And as you're doing that, you do this assessment, and it's like a layered assessment of like, what actions is the user taking? And then how are they feeling as they're sort of taking those actions, right? And what if we like were bold enough and took like 10 minutes of a lunch break, or 10 minutes before we go to bed, to say like, what is it that I really, really want? Like, I really want to connect with that. And what does that journey look like? Like, if I can map it out, then I can kind of silence that irrational mind, or tame it a little bit, to say like, this is not possible, to it is possible. Guess what? I just put it on paper, and I'll give myself a little bit more patience and time to be able to say like, okay, like I'll give myself over an X period of time to just try to dissect this a little bit more and see what it means from an emotional point of view, what actions I think I need to take, and like how I'm gonna like measure like my success in each of these points as I'm taking them. I actually did that exercise with myself, and it was actually really, really effective, because it helped me think objectively, but then it also forced me to say like, hey, wait a minute, don't shut your emotions off, because you're doing this. The reason why you are starting your business and being an entrepreneur is because it's coming from a place of joy, not because it's from a place of desperation or fear, right? So I don't know how you feel about that, but Is that like an assessment you'd be willing to do or want to do an exercise with people or even with yourself, right? To try to like break this all down.
You said something really, really powerful. You said, what do I need? And I think that's not a question that we're trained to ask ourselves very often. And even in the rare instances that we do ask that question, how honestly are we answering it, right? Like, because honestly, a few days ago, what I needed was a gin and tonic at 11 in the afternoon or in the morning.
I love that.
And that's okay. And what do I need can be such a powerful way to short circuit that fear or that imposter syndrome. What do I need is such a great way to offer yourself compassion and love and gratitude. And just kind of on the, to kind of track back to your question, there's also, I teach that there's a divide between, that there's a difference between self-care and self-love. So self-love are the things that make you feel good, right? Like the gin and tonic at 11 in the afternoon or the bubble bath with the glass of wine or the day that you give yourself sitting on the couch under a blanket, binge watching Netflix. That is self-love, and it's really, really important to practice that, but it isn't always self-care, because self-care sometimes looks like doing the hard things. And you know, self-care is about long-term building yourself into a more resilient person. It's about taking care of your mental and physical health. And so sometimes what you really need for your mental health is self-love, but sometimes what you need for your mental health is to put all of your devices and screens down and go outside for a walk, even though you really don't feel like it, because what you need is fresh air, or pushing through the workout that you don't really want to do, or not eating that pint of ice cream that you're really, really wanting to eat because it's going to make you sick in the morning and it's not going to fuel you, right? And the right way. And so actually making yourself something like healthy and colorful for your dinner. And so self-love is a part of self-care, but self-care isn't always self-love. Sometimes self-care is doing the hard thing or the difficult thing or the should thing, but telling yourself not I should do this, but I do this because I love myself, because I care about myself.
That is so powerful. That really brings everything into a full circle, right? You're embracing everything and you're not trying to shut off one thing for the other. It's such a balanced equation. Thank you so much for sharing that. I want to sort of ask you like a sort of like this final sort of question on my side, and happy to for you to make any like final thoughts as well. For the people that are watching this who work in tech or who want to work in tech, you know, you and I have talked about beforehand too, that like it ended up being very long hours. Like I'm sure that you get asked this question a lot, and I do as well, where it's like, what was it like working at Facebook, or what was it like working at PayPal? Like, I really want to work in tech, and I enjoy mentoring people in those areas, and because I still love tech and I still want to pursue it and do it in a way that I love and that is in my own definition, right? Sustainable and scalable. And one of the things that I find myself doing that might be against the grain or at odds with maybe what you're finding in the general ether of the web is being able to tell them the truth and say, like, you know, I've had these amazing experiences at working in tech and, you know, some of the tech companies that you're interested in doing, but it will end up being long hours. Hopefully not every day, but there will be many long hours. And it's like, you know, the question you sort of want to ask yourself, in my case, they're coming to me for career advice and they're coming to me for things like preparing them to get those skill sets to be able to enter these companies and be able to do well. And so I'm very keen on making sure that they can have a good good learning experience versus sort of like having everything sort of sideline and hit them sort of like a tornado. And so that's where I find a lot of my joy is to be able to do that preparation. So it's like, it's not just you getting the job and saying like, oh, okay, I got the job. This feels good. But it's like preparing them for what comes afterwards, that you are prepared with the right skill sets and, you know, intellectually as well, to be able to have short and long-term success. In your case, what I am inspired by you a lot is your ability to be able to mentally be able to prepare people, right? You've been doing it so well and for so long. And what advice do you have for the people, for women, right? Especially because we tend to have a lot of obligations outside of work as well. How do you, like, what advice would you give for an up-and-comer, a newcomer, or someone that's also in the field that might be like mid-senior or senior level? How do you prepare yourself in these long hour situations so that you can stay healthy, you can stay pleasant, you don't become bitter, like overly tired and burnt out? Because this is, you know, part of the reality of embracing tech, and it's just such a disservice that a lot of this conversation is not coming to light, where it's like, you can do this and I believe in you if you want to do it, but let's talk about how you can do it joyfully, right? And healthily and in a way that's sustainable and scalable, which we're both kind of tackling it from different ways. But if you think about it, we all ultimately need to have a lot of the skill sets that you're talking about as well. So what are those key takeaways that people, women especially, and people in tech can take away?
So I agree with everything that you say, that there's, you know, there's long hours, that it can be a really tough environment, that there isn't really, you never really feel like you know things because it's changing so quickly, that you're, you know, there's always somebody else who knows more, or the knowledge that you have becomes outdated really quickly. And those make the industry what it is, really exciting, really cutting edge, at the forefront of so much kind of awesome, game-changing social connection. I think when people come to me, particularly, you know, fresh, new to tech, keen to break in, the question I always ask is why? Because there's a lot of ways that you can make money, and it doesn't have to be working the long hours that come
with.
Amen
to that.
And so making sure that you're in it for the right reasons and that you have the right motivation behind you. I think too, like, if your motivation is specifically around the challenges that technology brings and solving some of those big problems, you know, I hear people talk a lot about like, well, like, I just love AR, VR. Well, then the work is always going to fuel you because you love the work. You're not in it for the money, and you're not going to resent the hours that you put in, because the hours that you put in are part of what brings you joy in life, right? So making sure that you're in it for the right reasons and that you have a motivation that's not just, I'm trying to put food on the table, is going to stop you from burning out and is going to make those hours joyful for you.
That's so powerful. And, you know, what's maybe, you know, no, that's okay. I was going to say bless you. You know, what's maybe one like final thing you could tell anyone working these long hours, like, what is like a quick, like, little quick exercise we can do to keep ourselves balanced? Because it's like, when you're consistently working those 14, 16 hour days, I always make this joke where it's like, hey, mom, dad, you wanted me to be a doctor, but I'm working just as long hours as a doctor in tech. Sometimes the mind will go, right? You're just so completely burnt out. You're just like, I just need to go home and just like defuse. Or sometimes the mind will be there, but then your body is just like, oh my God, like, I'm aching or something, 'cause you know, I've been on my standing desk or whatever. It's like one thing will sort of like kind of start fizzling out. And so when you're in that moment, like, what do you say to yourself to just be like, all right, like, let's regroup. You know, how do I recollect, you know, get what I need to get done, and then also make sure that I have time to maybe like decompress when I have like a break after my long day?
Yeah, I think knowing what it is that you need in order to decompress, right? Like, and knowing what's going to be best for you long term too, because sometimes I think what I really need is a glass of wine, but I know that that's going to affect my sleep, and I know that it's going to affect my mood the next day. So what's going to help me both decompress and be good for me in the long term? But overall, the one activity that I keep coming back to that's a really quick activity to do in order to prevent burnout is to draw two circles. And in the first circle, you divide it up, you know, like a pie chart, into the things that matter to you based on a percentage. So if, you know, family matters to you 50%, it'll take up 50% of the pie chart. And then in the second pie chart, how are you spending your time? And so if what's most important to you is family and you've given that 50% of your first pie chart, but in terms of time, you're only spending 10%, there's something wrong with that picture, right? And so the goal isn't to always be perfectly aligned. Like work-life balance doesn't look like 50% and 50%, but what it looks like is investing your time in a way that you want to be investing it in, and in a way that is sustainable for the long term, and in a way that brings you joy, whatever that looks like for you.
Yeah. And what you mentioned is powerful, because what you're essentially saying is that it's dynamic. Work-life balance is a very dynamic thing. And it's like you were saying earlier, it's constant. It just doesn't happen once and then you're sort of done with it. And sometimes that dynamic is something you might take day by day, depending on how busy you are. Sometimes it might be week by week. And if you have the luxury, maybe being able to kind of plan for the month as well. But when you're working in tech, like things are very agile and very fast moving. My term that I always use is like life is agile. And so it's like being willing to see it in that way. And it's like work is agile, life is agile. So it's like, instead of taking the time to scold yourself, which is sometimes I tend to be very hard on myself. Instead of doing that, it's like, well, wait a minute. Like I'm human. The situation, there's things I can control. There's things that I cannot control. So let me stop beating up on myself and use that energy to see what can I control now, and you know how I can maybe plan for in the next few days. And so I've definitely taken that agile sprint approach in all aspects of my life as well. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. And do you have any closing thoughts you would like to share with the audience, and also be able to follow your work, and if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram at Sari Day Coaching, or on LinkedIn, Sari Day, my last name spelled D-E. And that's where I am. I post tons of tips and tricks on how to navigate burnout. I do a lot of mini trainings on there too. So come along.
That is wonderful. I've taken away such profound points from you. I'm excited to share this episode with everyone, and I'll make sure that I have your contact in the description below, so that anyone that is looking for any coaching will also be able to reach out to you as well. So thank you again, Sari.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.